Today at Reader's Corner, part two of our interview with Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End.
This is a conflict that involves less than 1,000 Dakota warriors and several thousand Union soldiers. So in that case, it really is a part of the Civil War. Whatever deliberations had happened in Washington through Lincoln and his lawyers, this is still indiscriminate justice that is being delivered in a way that's sort of startling to us today. Little Crow is an unusual Dakota character because he was fascinated by white culture but doesn't embrace it. He's very well recorded in diaries and newspaper articles and in magazine articles.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today we're continuing an encore edition of our conversation with Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. The book is now out in paperback. In his book, Mr. Berg tells the compelling tale of the Dakota War of 1862 and its complex ties to the Civil War, which was happening at the same time. The book also details the fascinating story of Abraham Lincoln and his personal and surprisingly deep involvement in the judgment of more than 300 men condemned for their role in the Indian uprising. The result was the simultaneous hanging of 38 Dakota men, the 38 nooses of the book's title, in the largest government-sanctioned execution in American history. On last week's show, we discussed the major events of the Dakota War, including how Lincoln's action to personally sign the execution orders for the 38 Dakota men is now viewed through the long lens of history. Today, we'll talk more about the conflict and some of the fascinating personalities that Mr. Berg describes in his book. Scott Berg teaches nonfiction, writing, and literature at George Mason University, and he is a regular contributor to the Washington Post. He joins us by phone for this interview. Well, we've done a great job of covering the general outline of this tale, but inserted into the book are the stories of various people who were immediately involved in this conflict, either directly or indirectly. And I guess one of the obvious places to start is Sarah Wakefield and the role that she plays in this tale.
Yeah, thank you. Sarah Wakefield is one of sort of four major point of view characters. I don't write directly out of their point of view, but I follow them around, so to speak. Little Crow is one. Henry Whipple, the first Episcopal bishop of Minnesota, is another one. Lincoln and his cabinet would be sort of a third one. And then the other one is, among many other characters, these are sort of the main ones. The last one would be Sarah Wakefield. And the story sort of blends or braids together all their narratives, all their stories, and sort of moves back and forth between them. And Sarah Wakefield is an extraordinary person. Sarah Wakefield was taken captive. She's the wife of an agency physician, and what that means is the government, U.S. government Indian agencies that were on the reservation. He was the doctor at one of the two agencies in the Dakota reservations. And she, on the first day of this, she's taken captive along with her two children, very young, 1 year old and I believe 5 years old, and a son and a daughter. And she's taken captive along with about 300 other white women and children. As these killings are taking place in the settlements, generally, although many women and children were killed, generally women and children were taken captive and brought back to the sort of Little Crow's village and brought back to the sort of main encampment of the Dakota. And Sarah Wakefield is one of 300 people. One of the reasons that Sarah Wakefield was such a fascinating study and such an intriguing point of view character was because she writes a narrative after she survives and along with her children, and she writes a narrative after the war. And that narrative is called 6 Weeks in the Sioux Teepees, and it's really one of the most remarkable documents in American literary history. I have colleagues here at George Mason University, people elsewhere do this too, who argue that the women's Indian captivity narrative is America's only indigenous form of literature. And you know, the argument is pretty persuasive. After any Indian war where captives are taken, and that covers many, many, many Indian wars and many smaller and larger parts of conflict, a rash of these narratives appear, and in almost all cases, or in many cases at least, they follow a particular formula. They're very often edited or co-written by men, often members of the clergy, and they're presented as as tests of faith, a trial visited by God upon a pious settler whose survival is, of course, also credited to the will of God. Sir Wakefield's narrative is nothing like that. You can read the entire history of captivity narratives, and while some do stand out, hers stands out sort of especially boldly because she writes it herself, first of all, and she doesn't sort of plug it into the formula at all. Hers is very different because she was a woman with a reputation. She has come to Minnesota from Rhode Island under some sort of personal cloud. She wasn't on speaking terms with much of her family after she left. And that cloud is kind of ambiguous, but it seems to have to do with some scandal in Rhode Island, perhaps an affair, perhaps even a child out of wedlock, who knows? But it seems to have risen to that level. She arrives in Minnesota, she's taken captive, and in the course of her captivity, she's protected by a Dakota, what was called by whites a friendly Dakota named Chaska. She's protected the entire time. He and his family, Chaska's family, go to extraordinary lengths to keep Sarah and her children safe. And in the process of that, many of the other white captives begin to accuse her of being a phrase, something you hear in many conflicts, an Indian lover. The accusation leveled at Sarah Wakefield is that she has in fact become Chaska's lover. And she has in fact fallen in love with him, forsaken her husband, who she believed was dead at that point, and wasn't. But this accusation is leveled at her in the camps, it's leveled at her afterwards, and her narrative is fascinating because it is a refutation. It is a cry against that claim. And she admits a lot in order to refute the one charge that she was Chaska's lover, and it reads very much like a modern confessional memoir, you know, the kind we see on bookshelves over today, not like sort of a theological primer or a test of faith. And so we have this remarkable document where she's very revealing, very blunt and forthcoming, and makes her a character that we can sort of, from a much more modern point of view, I think, if not agree with all of her choices, we can empathize with her. And following her story through this also gives us a window into the Dakota camps that we otherwise wouldn't have.
Is her book still in print?
Because its copyright has run out, or you can get it in several different versions, actually. The version I have is from a wonderful book, a collected book called Women's Indian Captivity Narratives. And it's one of the narratives in there, along with some of the other really well-known narratives. But you can get it in many different forms. And it's an amazing read. There are parts that go on, parts that go off subject, parts that don't give you much detail, which gives us a window in. Just as Little Crow is an unusual Dakota character because his life was so well documented, even if he didn't write something himself, as a leader, as somebody who was, he's unusual in that he's fascinated by white culture but doesn't embrace it. He dabbles in a whole lot of white culture. And because of that, he's very well recorded in diaries and newspaper articles and magazine articles. And so he becomes somebody where you can, there's more to read about, more to understand about him in terms of source material. And so like Sarah Wakefield, a lot of the people that I write feature and whose narratives I feature in this book are the people who left behind certain kinds of records that were unusual. There are unheard voices in this story, the average Dakota warrior, the average farm wife out on the frontier. But that's in many ways a necessary pitfall of writing any narrative history. And Sarah Wakefield is someone whose life is so vivid and presented so sort of dramatically that you can't help but follow her around.
Now, the Dakota who protected her, Chaska, he was one of the 38 who was hung?
Yeah, this is one of the, you know, there's many, many tragedies. This is not a tragedy. It's sort of a set of tragedies, like a Chinese nesting doll of tragedies, one inside the other. But one of the most poignant tragedies is that Chaska simply means, in Dakota, the word Chaska, and I'm pronouncing it in an anglicized way, it's Chaske, it's closer to the Dakota pronunciation, but Chaska means firstborn if a male. So if your firstborn son was a male, that was in Chaska. And there were many, many Dakota young men named Chaska, kind of like Steve or our names, a very sort of common name. And there's this horrible moment of misunderstanding where he's in a very large group of prisoners and they come to call out the 38 condemned. And very important to note at this time, none of the hundreds and hundreds of Dakota and Penn had ever been informed of their sentences. The trials had taken place, and by the end they were just sort of kangaroo court trials. But by the end of these trials, all these decisions had made, but they'd never been announced. So they still had hundreds and hundreds of prisoners in these enclosures. And even when they came the few days before the execution to separate out the 38 who were to be hanged, they just read out the names and the men had no idea. They read out the name Chaska. He raised his hand and came forward. It was there was three or four Chaskas at least in that enclosure, and he wasn't he had originally been sentenced to death. That sentence was stayed by Lincoln, but he steps forward, and the Chaska who was intended for hanging apparently didn't say anything. We don't know the story there. He steps forward, and only when later, a day later or so, does he understand that he's to be hanged, and it's unbelievably poignant when you understand Sarah Wakefield didn't stick around for the hanging. She went to another town on the other side of the state. And only in January, a couple weeks after the hanging, did she read in a newspaper article that the Chaska that had spent so long protecting her, and the Chaska for whom she spoke in defense at his trial, had actually been hanged. And it's a moment that just breaks your heart, because you understand whatever deliberations had happened in Washington through Lincoln and his lawyers, this is still indiscriminate justice that is being delivered in a sort of a in a way that's sort of startling to us today.
You're listening to part two of our interview with Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. You know, going back to the original decision by Little Crow to stand with his young warriors, one of the questions we talked about last week was just whether or not Little Crow understood what he was headed for. And I gathered to some extent he did, and it must have had something to do with the fact that Little Crow was pretty cognizant of the power of the federal government. He had visited Washington, and didn't he even meet with the president? Was Lincoln in office then, or was it?
No, not with Lincoln. He'd met actually with secretaries of state. Okay. He'd met with members of cabinets on two separate visits. These were treaty-related visits. But no, he had been out to Washington, D.C. He took the train. He took the riverboat down to the railhead in Illinois, perhaps in Wisconsin. And then he took a train to Chicago, and then he took a train from Chicago. And he was very, very much interested in white culture. Again, he never adopted white culture fully, as some Dakota did, either under duress or by choice. But he would wear a collared white shirt, which was sort of a sign of the white world. But then he wouldn't cut his hair. He accepted the government-issued brick house that was given him as a leader to sort of create a farmstead. But he lived in his teepee next to the house. He attended Episcopal church services, apparently on a fairly regular basis, but never took baptism. And this was a really unusual sort of middle ground that Little Crow occupied. But of all the Dakota, he had seen more of the world than probably any Dakota alive, perhaps than any Dakota ever at that point. He had been out west, he had been out east, he had been in major white population centers, he had traveled to many, many different tribes and villages in the west. And so he does have a much more expansive viewpoint. He's also older. I think he's 50 at the point, or around 50. And, you know, that's quite a lifespan in 1862 for a Dakota. And he's confronted by these young men who want to go to war. And these young men, again, teens, 20s, anxious to go to war. By that point, he's kind of lived his life in terms of he's been a leader. He's less of a leader at this point. And they come to him, and they don't want him to become their general. These young men who come and say, we want to go to war against the whites. We want to do this. They don't want him to become their general and take, quote-unquote, command. What they need is less his command or his rifle than they need his voice. They need him to become someone who can speak for this. They need someone who can be seen as an elder to have counseled with them and reached a community decision on this. And in the end, not only does he sort of see what's coming, but he's probably the only one who truly sees what's coming and says, at the end of this first council where the decision to go to war is made, Little Crow says, I am no coward. I will die with you, or he probably speaks in the third person. Little Crow is no coward. He will die with you. And the idea of an honorable death is here. The idea of a point of no return is sort of locked within that statement as well. And Little Crow eventually seems to be the person that knows this is going to end. This resistance is going to end with my death, and perhaps it's going to end with the scattering of the Dakota. But he decides that that's the choice that's left them. And he becomes a very sort of poignant figure in that regard. He's also fascinating in that his desires and the desires of these young people in terms of killing women versus taking them captive, in terms of attacking here versus there, in terms of suing for peace with the white generals or not suing for peace with the white generals, his desires and their desires don't always match up. And I think it would have been startling, or beyond startling, it would have been shocking and probably unbelievable for many, many white soldiers and residents of the Northwest to have sat inside those camps and heard the dissension and the bickering and the earnest arguments for and against peace, for and against releasing the captives or keeping the captives. And so Little Crow in this position has no power in the sense of a George McClellan or a general who can order people on the field. Rather, his voice and his persuasion and his ability to succeed in council is what matters. And so when he agrees to be the face of this, he does know what's coming. And that seems to be part of his role in it, the person who seems to have an understanding of the wider perspective in this. And he doesn't always agree with the desires of these young men.
And, of course, he's not among the 38 who are hung. And help us understand how that happened and, unfortunately, how he did eventually meet violence.
He escapes with a group of warriors out into the Dakota Territory. And it's at first it's... I mean, when he leaves the camps in Minnesota, the white forces led by a man named Henry Hastings Sibley are a day away, and they have just defeated a large group of Dakota warriors in a battle called Wood Lake, which is the sort of the final action, out by the border of Minnesota and the Dakota Territory. Sibley and his soldiers, many thousands strong, are about a day away, and so Little Crow says, anybody that's coming with me, we're going, and bring some captives along, a very small group of captives. But so maybe 1,000 Dakota head out towards the Dakota Territory. Many stay behind, trusting that they will be treated well by whites. Unfortunately, a trust that didn't really pan out. But Little Crow and about 1,000, within weeks, that thousands is down to a few hundred. And then he heads, as you mentioned last week, to Devil's Lake by the Canadian border, where he attempts to enlist the support of other Indian tribes. That doesn't go so well. He actually crosses the border into Canada and tries to sort of call in old debts from the British there related to the War of 1812. That goes predictably badly. At this point, he's really sort of tilting at windmills, trying to figure out a way to... And in the end, the tragic and poignant and fascinating part of Little Crow's story is he and a very small group of warriors decide to go back into Minnesota. And there's no record of exactly why. But as soon as they cross the border back into Minnesota, and by this time there's a bounty on the scalp of any Dakota Indian in the state. You could kill a Dakota Indian, take their scalp, and no questions would be asked, and you'd receive, depending on where you were, you'd receive a cash prize for that. He's heading back into Minnesota with a small group, maybe 24 warriors. Very soon, that group splits off from him, leaving Little Crow with his son, Wawinape, his eldest son, and his son, who's, by the way, he's about, I think, 16, 17 at that point, and he's been with him the entire time, prosecution war, and they head by themselves sort of back toward the Minnesota River Valley, and it's one of the... It's an unanswered question, but what was he doing? Was he going to touch the waters again? We don't know. They're picking raspberries in a raspberry patch, very near sort of where the war first was sparked, and they're out in the middle of the field, and a couple of settlers named Lamson, a father and son, spot them in the field and open fire, and eventually, you know, after a few shots are exchanged, Little Crow is wounded fatally. He goes down. His son hurriedly prepares his body sort of for the trip to the afterlife. It involves placing moccasins by the body and takes some of his objects, and his son runs off, leaving him there. And this is the end of Little Crow, and it happens almost a year to the day, short 1 month of when the war began. But most poignantly, it happens on the last day, July 3rd. It happens on the last day of Gettysburg. While this is happening in Minnesota, Pennsylvania, the tide of sort of the war has finally turned for the Union. And then Little Crow's story becomes even more ignominious. And after this, his body is sort of paraded through the streets of a nearby town. Eventually, his skull and some of his artifacts are placed in the Historical Society of Minnesota. This is, you know, toward the turn of the 20th century this happens. And only after efforts sort of much later are his remains returned to the Dakota. And so his end is definitely not a bang. It's a whimper in the story, and all sort of wrapped up in this question of why did he come back to Minnesota, which is, if you were a novelist, you could put yourself in, you know, especially if you were a Dakota novelist and could sort of put yourself inside that mind. What is he doing in coming back alone, essentially, with his son to Minnesota? And that's his end. And a lot of the end of this doesn't happen in sort of big bang-up battlefield scenes, but in smaller scenes just like that one.
You're listening to Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End.
Do I remember that his son goes on to supply some of the knowledge and information we know about those days?
Yeah, his son is... His son eventually, fascinating, takes a white name, and he becomes, down the road, he becomes the founder of the first Dakota branch of the YMCA in Minnesota. Leads a fascinating life, but didn't do much talking about the Dakota War. But in one case, a white ex-soldier, lawyer, poet named Hanford Lennox Gordon, who a lot of people, kind of a local author with some notoriety, he had interviewed Little Crow back in 1860. He was one of these people who liked to collect Dakota legends and stories. And about 20 years after the war, he interviews Winnipeg, and he writes up Little Crow's son's recollections of the war. And that's where we get our best known account of the original council, where the young men attempt successfully to enlist Little Crow in the cause of going to war. And that's an example of where the source material is so difficult, because this is a poet and newspaper man, an ex-soldier who's interested in collecting these stories. He's doing it 20 plus years after the fact. He's pitching it for a white audience. This is in the 1880s, when the country had just begun sort of to experience its mania of nostalgia for the frontier era, because sort of that whole phenomenon of instant history, that the second the frontier is declared closed, then we celebrate all things Indian, and we name all our streets. I grew up on a street in Minnesota called Cohansey. Now it's not a Dakota word. It's from a New Jersey. We don't know exactly how it traveled to Minnesota, but there's a Dakota county, a Chaska county, a town called Chaska in Minnesota. We immediately do this. And so he's writing this in the 1880s for a white audience that's actually, you know, thrilled to be, you know, hearing this story and suffused with nostalgia. And so you have to try to cut through all this and try to decide, okay, what is likely to be reliable in this and what is likely not to be reliable. But he does provide our best account of the beginning of the war that we have, but he provides it 25 years later.
Here we are in our second week of an interview on your book, and we still haven't covered all the interesting personalities that you bring forth in this book. One that fascinated me was General John Pope, and the reason it did is because it seemed as though that it was his zealous pursuit of the executions that brought Lincoln into play here, and he had lost his command back east. That's the reason he was out west, so to speak, northwest. It raises the question whether or not these military men who were stationed in the Indian territories, were they the rejects from the Civil War, which was our major preoccupation?
Well, that's an interesting question, because this is one of the key points of connection between the Dakota War and the Civil War, and there are many, many in the book, sort of both small and larger. But great question, were the men who fought against the Dakota region? Well, John Pope felt he was, and he was angry about it. I mean, that's a good place to start. John Pope is the general, the son of an old family friend of Abraham Lincoln and back in Illinois. And John Pope had some minor success along the Mississippi very early in the Civil War, and when Lincoln began to be tired of McClellan's slow pace and his inaction and his unwillingness, he sort of split up the duties of the commanding the Union Army in Virginia and gave John Pope the charge of sort of facing Lee's army. Well, it's John Pope that loses the second battle of Bull Run in August of 62, and in really bumbling fashion. I mean, Lee makes him look like a fool as a general. And, you know, they meet in Manassas for this battle, and they think it might be going well, and suddenly you're in Washington, D.C., and soldiers from Pope's army are pouring back into Washington, D.C., sort of helter-skelter. I mean, you know, under no real sort of, organized fashion. I mean, and Pope had done a lot of bragging when he came out to Virginia about what a good general he was. So this was a really bad situation. His soldiers hated him, and Lincoln realized this was no solution. So he gives command back to McClellan, but he needs to do something with John Pope. Well, to make what's always a long story, very short, he says, wait, we've got this Indian conflict, and we're going to create a new federal military department of the Northwest, and we're going to send John Pope out there. Pope is furious. He feels he's not only received a demotion, he feels he's been sent off to a hinterland. He gets on a train, and he gets there, and he immediately declares Armageddon. He immediately, once he receives St. Paul, he starts giving orders to Sibley out in the field. At the time, Colonel Sibley, but who would soon become General Sibley, out in the field, with no understanding of the situation, with no sort of, and really with part of his mind always focused on wanting to get, you know, back into his rightful position in the conduct of the Civil War. And so when he comes out, he's bitter, he's angry. What's interesting is the average, so at first militia are sort of called up to fight this, but very soon it becomes clear that they're going to need federal. So when Pope's coming, this is already after Union soldiers had been sort of enlisted, and those were not rejects in the sense that there was a big fort at the confluence of the Mississippi and the Minnesota called Fort Snelling, just a major northwest fort, very, very near where St. Paul was springing up. And at Fort Snelling, there was regiment after regiment after regiment of Union soldiers who had enlisted in the Union Army were being sent off. I think there were six already regiments have been sent off, some east, most south, though, down the Mississippi to fight in the Western theater of the Civil War. And what happened, essentially, is they put the brakes on. They said, don't get on that steamboat, boys, to go off to the Civil War. Turn around, you're going to go out to the prairie, and you're going to fight against the Dakota. And some soldiers were, you know, as angry and bitter about that as John Pope was. They had signed up to fight the Secesh, the Confederates. But as a group, they kind of took their charge as soldiers and did this. And it was, from the white point of view of the settlers, it was very lucky that they had this training ground with, you know, thousands of Union soldiers who were just about to be sent out. They could be turned around, and eventually Wisconsin regiments join it. So Pope is the one who views himself as a reject, but actually once the Union Army gets involved, this is a conflict that involves less than 1,000 Dakota warriors and several thousand Union soldiers. So in that case, it's not even separate from the Civil War. It really is a part of the Civil War, Union soldiers being sent westward to fight the Dakota.
Scott, I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to interview you, not just 1 week, but 2 weeks. And this has just been a great opportunity to explore the issues you've raised in your book. I highly recommend it to our listeners. It's 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. The author, Scott W. Berg, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Scott W. Berg. Next week, Dan Hurley, author of Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.